Welcome back to the Worst Podcast.
Hello, good to we can't see you, but we can feel you.
Yeah.
And we know you're there.
I always feel like I'm starting a YouTube video whenever I introduce this.
And not a vlog.
Yeah. Hello, welcome back to the Worst Podcast.
It's almost like there are some conventions of opening sort of media, and we sort of fall into the traps that we think are normal. So it's like, hi. So I think we're doing an impression of vloggers.
Yeah.
Was that a bit too meta for less than 40 seconds in? I feel a bit weird today.
That's okay. It's just, it's Beatrix's birthday week.
Yeah, so...
I refer to myself in the third person.
I've heard on good authority it's actually Beatrix's birthday week.
Yeah, so we're on a high, we're riding a wave.
Yeah, I'm a bit hungover actually.
Yeah, me and Harry went to the pub last night.
Yeah, I think it started off as lunch, and then didn't leave till about... I certainly drank till about 8 p.m, 9 p.m.
I was there for longer.
And then kept going.
Yeah, kept going.
So
anyway,
enough nonsense and silliness and fluff on the top.
This episode has been much anticipated for us too. A long time coming. Harry's excited for it.
Yeah. You've all been waiting with bated breath for the discussion and an examination into the theories behind the Dyatlov Pass incident.
Don't forget
the incident.
We briefly actually quite thoroughly touched on this last time.
So if you haven't heard the last episode, you're gonna have to go back, because we're not gonna talk about the story today. We're just gonna talk about what happened. Should we do a recap?
We'll do a brief overview. If you want the deets.
Yeah, if you want to actually know, yeah, because we'll be sort of coming back to the details we'd mentioned in the previous ep. So we'll give you now to go and start. Right, okay, ready now. All right, that's enough.
Yeah,
good job.
And we'll
thanks for doing the homework. You've done the reading, well done. You can come to this lecture and understand what's going on now.
And on that note, we'll dive straight in to the theories.
Okay, quick recap for people who weren't making notes the first time. So I'm gonna do this off the top of my head, so forgive me. Right, it is February 1959. There are 10 hikers who go into the Ural Mountains.
I thought it was nine.
There are 10.
Okay.
One goes
home.
Remember, Yuri Yulin goes home.
I was even here when we did it.
You're on the show, B.
I should know that.
So 10 hikers go into the Ural Mountains. One goes home. His name's Yuri Yudin. He's in a survivor.
His name's what?
Yuri Yudin. And it doesn't sound like urine, and stop thinking it does. And basically, they camp, and they slash their tenor from the inside, and they calmly walk to the tree line. Two members die.
It's snowing everywhere, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
It's freezing cold. Minus 40 degrees.
Yeah, Ural Mountains. And two members die by a cedar tree after trying to climb up and start a fire. Another three members die sort of...
Doesn't sound like a very good idea about making a fire in a tree.
They climb a tree and then they make a fire. Sorry, I forgot to say the comma. Three members die making their way... Oh, they die, haha, lol. Have some revenants, Beatrix.
Apologies.
Three members die as they walk back into the tent... probably of hypothermia. We'll get to that, though. There is some conjecture.
Yeah.
And then four members die in a different location with catastrophic injuries, sort of broken ribs, head traumas, missing eyes, missing tongues, and the like. And also there's instances with, like, clothes.
Two of them found on the way back to the tent. Three found on the way back to the tent.
Yeah. Okay, so you got two cedar trees.
Two cedar trees.
Yeah, so it's called two at the cedar tree.
Yeah.
Three on the slope up to the tent, and then four...
in the forest.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the premise, and there's a lot to unpack there. So, but hopefully you know where... You kind of know what's going on. You know what's going on, right? Because there's reading for this episode. There's homework you have to do.
Yeah.
And so if you've done the homework, it's your fault, all right?
Yeah, you paused it.
You go do your homework, all right? Okay, yeah. We'll get into it now. Okay, the first theory we're going to talk about is the KGB theory, and here's how it goes. A few of the members of the 10-strong hiking team were actually working for the KGB. They had a secret mission, unbeknownst to the rest of the group, which was to deliver radioactive samples as a red herring to confuse the Americans, during a setting of like Cold War tensions. They had so much camera gear, so they could actually spy and record the Americans in the area.
Okay.
But something goes wrong, and the Americans kill them. So it's okay. It's already I was like, well, that seems a bit vague.
Very far fetched.
And quite far fetched.
A bit like fiction. Bit
yeah, fun. I mean, and there is some things that kind of could bolster this. So some of the group do actually have fairly credible ties, or could have credible ties to the KGB. Sasha Zolotarev, 38, he was significantly older than the rest of the group. He joined at the last minute, and he was a combat veteran that served for the NKVD, which is essentially like the Russian secret police.
Mm-hmm.
He bore a tattoo, untranslatable into any language, which says... which
so like code or something?
Yeah, exactly, something like that. It said, Deamun Unzoyana. Right, so essentially, to us it's gibberish, but it must mean something.
It must have meant something to him, but yeah. To us it's double Dutch, doesn't mean me.
Yeah. And also you've got Alexander Kolaratov. Before transferring to the Eurotechnic Institute, which is where all they came from,
mm-hmm.
He worked as a lab assistant at an unnamed atomic lab called P.O. Box number 3394.
That was the name of the lab,
P.O. Yeah, because it was like a secret lab, so it wasn't called like.
Oh, so it needed like
atomic lab number 4 on this address. Yeah, it was like a lot of the secret atomic
code names.
The labs had no names; they're just called P.O. Box, whatever.
Their post box address.
Yeah, just their postage. You know, this is a secret. It's just a secret. Just their address.
Just tell me where you could contact me.
Yeah, and then Yuri Kroshenko, he worked at a plant called Mayak in Chelyabinsk. Which suffered a terrible meltdown, which really is not remembered nowadays, only because of like Chernobyl. It was
terrible, but it's been overshadowed.
I looked into it. So there's 7 different sort of classifications for a disaster, like a nuclear disaster. It was classed as a level 6 serious incident.
Oh my god!
And Chernobyl's a level 7.
Oh,
so,
I see. He worked there at that plant.
He worked there. 10,000 people from 22 villages were evacuated. So,
oh my goodness.
So
yeah, yeah.
These guys, there is some sort of like shadiness to a few of them.
Yeah.
But I'm not convinced with this one.
The hikers had radioactive.
Yeah, exactly.
Evident particles on them.
Yeah, right. So that this theory also tries to explain the radioactive clothes.
Yeah.
So while the background of a few of the hikers does raise an eyebrow, so you've got someone who worked for secret police and you've got 2 atomic scientists, considering they're really bright science students at the height of the Cold War, is it all that unusual that they'd work in atomics? That's kind of what Russia was trying to do at the time.
Yeah.
And they are like fresh new minds. Chances are, yeah, you're going to work in atomics if you're... A lot of them are physics students.
Yeah, makes sense.
And how many men of...
So that makes it less suspicious.
I think so. And how many men of Sasha Zolotarev's age fought in World War II? So he's 38 in 1958 and 1959. 34 million servicemen fought for the Soviets in World War II.
And
So I think anyone of his age would have probably fought in World War II. So
and was he the secret police member of the...
Yeah, he was the older guy.
Yeah, and they were everywhere, weren't they, secret police?
Yeah, that's kind of...
Even in Germany, they were.
Exactly.
East Germany.
And I tell you what, the thing that this theory does have going for it, I think, is it explains the cameras... Where, you know, if you remember, Sasha had a secret camera which he took with him.
And he grabbed it when he ran out the tent.
So that, there's something about that. Sasha is really scrutinised quite heavily by a lot of these theories. They think he's a really shady figure. He's sort of the odd one out of the group. And there's another theory where he was like, we won't get into this theory, but there's another theory on a slight tangent, which basically said that there was a group of Soviet officers in the area on a hunting trip, and the local Mansi tribe were helping them with that hunting trip, and there was like an embargo on using any military equipment. You couldn't do it because the tensions were so high with the West.
I see, yeah.
At this specific time, you couldn't use anything, and those group of officers used like a military helicopter, and it's thought that Sasha photographed it, and so they had to cut, and then that's why he took the camera, because it was like
evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then, so there's a lot to be made of that. But that's what this. So this is in conclusion, this theory.
Yeah.
Don't think it holds much water, but it is interesting about the camera thing. That's a nice
explanation. One of the theories that I looked at explains things that other theories don't explain. Mm-hmm. So it could be a part of the bigger story that don't necessarily stand alone.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be, you know, it could, it might, yeah, exactly. So these theories, in this case, could be theories woven together, couldn't it? Yeah. Could be the actual truth.
But. Yeah. And in this case, they left the tent in a hurry, but he thought to pick up his camera, so that makes some sort of sense.
Also, if it's the KGB, why would, doesn't explain the tent. So I guess you're saying the tent, that's this theory saying the tent got attacked. Well, why were they slashed up the inside? Why would they not run away?
And
I don't think it does much for me personally. Right, should we move on?
Yeah.
So something we haven't mentioned as of yet is the stove.
The cooking.
Yeah. So the stove represents quite a compelling, if incomplete, explanation of what happened that night.
Okay.
One of the most troubling details in the whole case is the question of what made them leave their tent. Why did they slash open their tent and then walk away?
Yeah.
Because that's undisputed, but that is...
Yeah, because the sense of urgency directly followed by a sense of unurgency.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it had to be a danger from inside the tent itself. If someone was outside, like the KGB, or if it was like a avalanche or UFO or whatever,
why would you leave
the tent? Yeah. Yeah. It has to be more dangerous inside the tent than outside the tent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So their tent was kitted out with a custom built stove designed by Igor Dyatlov. It was homemade. And if you look at photos of their camp before disaster struck, you can see the big exhaust pipe.
It's like a big stove.
Yeah, which would channel the smoke out of the tent.
Yeah. So is it incorporated into the tent?
Yeah, there's like a hole for it, but they'd pack it away and stuff.
Okay.
So perhaps a fire.
Yeah. Okay.
It's going to explain the slash of the tent. So let's say there's a little fire at first. Smoke sort of arises, and so you cut little holes to try and alleviate the smoke. It doesn't work. So you're panicking, you get scared. You can't see, you can't breathe. You probably start breaking out.
You don't think I've got time to open the zip.
No, you slash the tent, you'll pile out, dressed in whatever you're wearing. And we know that stove was used that night because there was partially... found sort of like fried ham, and it was their meal that they cooked with the stove was found sort of half eaten.
Mm-hmm.
This would also explain why they didn't run. So they pile out, they're terrified. Maybe they're cursing Dyatlov and his stove, and they're trying to work out what to do next. They know they need shelter, and with the smoke still swirling inside the tent, they can't go back in. So they make for the tree line in the forest, and they don't run because there's no
immediate danger again.
The stove was found completely packed away. Many believe this actually lends itself to the theory that the embers inside were packed away, and then that's how the fire started. Sort of.
Okay. Yeah.
My problem with the theory is it's just not complete. It explains why they abandoned the tent, but then why the group split up, what killed them with the injuries, etc., etc., etc. Like, you know, it explains a small part of it.
Yeah. Is it like another one where it explains part of the theory that other theories don't?
Yeah. So I think this could be the truthful event. This could have definitely happened.
Yeah.
And it could have been the start of that awful night. But then
what happened subsequently?
We're still very far away from knowing exactly what happened afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to do one of my theories now, which is a similar situation in that it explains certain parts of the story, but doesn't explain the whole picture, but makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's called The Altercation on the Pass. And it's... evidence is based on the autopsies and some of the injuries which the hikers got that weren't caused on the night, but probably before the night happened.
Oh, okay.
And therefore leads to other theories.
Mm-hmm.
They all make sense when I explain it. So there's this man called, I think he's a doctor or pathologist, called Eduard Tumanov. And he was involved with the Dyatlov case, and he pushes a theory that the hikers took part in a fight, either between them or with outsiders mm-hmm. on the way. So his observations are based on the autopsy reports and mainly what is missing from them. So looking at the official records, the Dyatlov group members have injuries sustained perhaps a day or two before the onset of death. So this is like scratches, bruises, abrasions, etc., which are common for injuries from blunt objects such as fists, a branch, just any solid object. And they had them on their faces and their hands, and the abrasions were covered with like a crust, and their bruises were turning green, which shows that they were like old wounds, fairly old wounds. Mm-hmm. And this indicates that the duration of the injury is greater than those minutes, hours that could have been occurred before their deaths. So they were like on their way, or they were already healing.
Right, yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? So they could have been gained in a fight. This is what he says. They could have been gained in a fight, but most likely the group would have come into conflict with someone in the area of the pass. One of the hikers, Krivoshenko, was found together with Doroshenko near an extinct fire under a cedar tree.
Yeah, so the cedar tree group, yeah.
Yeah, the cedar tree group. And the lower left half of the tree was missing up to the level of the knee joint. And the edges of his trouser fabric were uneven, as if they'd been ripped, I think, with the fabric being charred and his leg being burned.
So the when you say the leg was burned, they had quite a lot of burns on their bodies, actually. And so that can people link that back to the stove theory,
yeah, yeah.
That the fire like hurt them. They were burned either, you know, before or after. Because you could suggest that maybe, you know, they were so cold and they had their fire. Maybe they sort of leaned into it by mistake. You see that quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know the Donner party?
Yeah, I know the Donner.
Quite often you'll find that people...
The same thing happened
people
to them.
Got really badly burned because they were so cold they sort of fell into the fire almost without realising.
Yeah, because you lost feeling when mm-hmm. you're that
you're so numb
chilly.
And you're sort
I
of like...
I said chilly as if it wasn't sub-zero. Just a bit of a draft.
Severely chilly.
Yeah,
this
was one of the first things which Tumilov noticed was a bit odd that it hadn't been reported or like investigated properly.
Mm-hmm.
But there were more abrasions to the body, mainly the head actually. So in the centre of the frontal region, the left of the temple region and the area from the right temple to the nape, it had internal hemorrhage. Or evidence of internal hemorrhaging.
I think some people say, couldn't he have fallen? Because they were desperately trying to climb the tree. They could have fallen out of the tree, couldn't they? I think people.
Yeah,
some people consider
possibly,
that.
Possibly. But it suggests a strong blow as if they'd fallen or had been hit hard.
Mm-hmm.
Or multiple blows to the temporal and rear region of the head.
Mm-hmm.
The person who did the autopsy, the expert, does not describe external damage to the... He doesn't basically... These do not appear on the report.
Yeah.
So they're there,
yeah.
But he doesn't. The autopsy doesn't say anything about them.
Yeah.
Even though they were visible bruises.
We'll come to that again. There was it's a fact, there was a slight cover up that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really weird. I mean, we'll come on to that further on. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also, the rear of the right hand in Krivoshenko was swollen. This was where the knuckles were. And the autopsy wrote that the soft tissues were a whitish-grey in colour and the fingers were brown-violet.
Mm-hmm.
And on the back of these fingers, there is minor skin abrasions, which is like you would see if you've been punching or in a fight.
Yeah.
And so the theory is that Krivoshenko was beaten on the head and that he hit his right fist, possibly punching someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep reading the autopsy report, it says that in the middle of the third finger...
That's gone, isn't it?
The defect on the epidermis, so the skin,
yeah.
Is in the shape and size which coincides with that in the oral cavity. So basically, he's bit off the skin on his finger.
Yeah.
And they think that possibly this is because he was beaten or tortured and he couldn't stand the pain, so he bit off his skin as if to stop himself like screaming or...
Yeah.
I
think yeah, okay, I've heard that as well. Where there's a lot made of that, and a lot is made of that. Excuse me. So like, people then also could have him sort of like, let's say he froze to death, he's trying to like, keep lucid and conscious, so to stop him falling asleep, and dying. He's trying to bite him and keep him conscious.
Yeah.
So or he's just like, he's totally devastated and is terrified. And he's like trying not to cry. People think that's what he's trying to stifle a sob.
Yeah. Which would make sense for the fight if he was.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's just a really
so many theories.
So
many
bizarre.
Theories.
It's so bizarre, isn't it? Like, what made him do that? None of them I think we can agree, are very nice.
There's no nice reasons why that poor... I mean, it's a very horrible story.
There's no nice reasons that poor guy did that.
So Tumalov, in his opinion, he thinks that all the bodies should be exhumed and subjected to a new full autopsy for the missed and omitted details. So he suggests, or he promotes this because of the following reasons. So this is probably going to tie into anything that might resemble a cover-up.
Yep.
So when the bodies were first found, there was no forensic expert present to observe the position and overall condition of the bodies and the way they were discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And upon discovery, the clothes and the position of the corpses are described very superficially. So there's not much detail about that.
Yeah, for example, the really famous bit where Ludmilla, she has her tongue missing.
Mm-hmm.
I think literally it's just something like tongue not present. It's something like that.
There's like no...
It really skimps out on detail in a lot of places. Like the tongue, not, does that not seem a bit more important?
Yeah.
Tongue not present. Like, is it been bitten? Is it been sliced? Has it been ripped?
And this is the point that he's trying to make.
Yeah.
So there was no forensic survey of the scene of the incident. Photos were uninformative and the images looked more like artistic shooting than a criminalistic style photographs.
Yeah.
The conclusions in the first five autopsy reports before some of them weren't found until later.
Yeah, yeah, the people in the ravine, the more catastrophic injuries in the ravine weren't found until much later, were they?
Yeah.
So the five talking about the people...
In the woods.
Yeah, so the tree line people, so people who have done hypothermia and the cedar boys.
Mm-hmm. And the conclusions and their autopsy results were copied and pasted with their names being different. So, for example, the death of Doroshenko was caused by low temperature as evidenced by swelling of the, I don't know how that says, meninges?
I don't know.
Swelling of some body part. a sharp replenishment of the internal organs, overflow of dark blood of the heart cavities, the presence of Vyshenko spots in the gastric mucosa, and frostbite fingers of limbs, etc.
That's copy pasted for
all of them.
Okay, so
they all say the same.
So Slobodin, Kormogov, Dyatlov, Koshenko, and Doroshenko.
Yeah.
I've got that name wrong.
There's two more points he makes. In each of the nine acts, the expert indicates that pieces of internal organs were taken for histological examination, but only four have results in the criminal case.
Mm.
It can be assumed that the histology of the first five bodies was deliberately concealed, as it was clearly more informative than the bodies found 2 months later.
There's so much. It's like with the investigation and the autopsy, there's so much stuff that is purposely omitted. Because
mm-hmm.
It started off, when this was first reported and found, they treated it as a crime, didn't they? So it was criminal investigations.
Yeah.
But then that kind of stopped when they were like, well, we just don't know what happened.
Yeah, it's just too many questions.
Yeah.
And then finally, the location of the liver mortis spots does not coincide with the position of some of the corpses at the time of the discovery.
Yeah. Do you also have liver mortises? So it's like blood spots, wasn't it? If you're in a pool of blood or something, it just shows that a body's been tampered with.
Yeah.
Because it's been repositioned after it's died, essentially, isn't it? So it's like patches that show that.
Yeah.
Slobodin
and Doroshenko were found face down, and the expert describes the liver mortis spots on the back of their bodies.
Yeah.
And Kormogova. Kormogova has the same description, which, as stated in the examination certificate, was found lying on her side.
Yeah.
So, all in all, bit very, very, very.
There's just some dodgy stuff with the autopsies.
It raises more questions than it answers.
Yeah.
Which is really frustrating.
Great. Cheers, Pete. No, well researched. Good effort.
Yeah, that happens a lot with these series.
Yeah, exactly.
So many more questions. You
like,
have
okay,
before.
Well, now I know. It's like I said at the first episode where. We're not back at square one. We're further back than square one.
Yeah.
We're square minus one. Because now there's more questions than we realise.
Because it just confuses you.
Yeah.
It's like a spiral.
Oh, that's good though. That's interesting. I'm not going to spend too much time on these next two, but they are kind of glaring and worth mentioning.
Okay.
So the first one is the Yeti theory. There is essentially no evidence for this Yeti theory. But given the brutal injuries that some of them sustained, and I guess it happened in the snow,
yeah,
people can't help but speculate there was a Yeti. there's a particularly egregious National Geographic. No, it's Discovery. Sorry, it's Discovery. It's not National Geographic, it's Discovery. cool.
Now, but to really dispute the sources and the...
Yeah, it's called Russian Yeti, the Killer Lives. Disgusting. Disgusting.
The killer lives.
Yeah, so basically what apparently counts for a fun Soviet pastime is you make a little... your own little newspaper, which sort of would, it was full of like jokey headlines and like funny satire, and it was basically like to commemorate the trip itself.
Yeah.
And they said in the quotes, from now on, we know the snowman exists. And so people have taken that definite joke, right?
Yeah.
To mean, oh my God.
The Yeti.
They had seen the Yeti.
That's so funny.
So, and then there's another bit of evidence, which is actually my lock screen.
The photo of the Yeti.
Basically,
it's a bit weird. For those listening, didn't get to see that.
We'll post it on the thing. The other bit of evidence we point to is a blurry picture of a figure in a forest, a big lumbering figure that leans to one side, one hand on a tree. And I think it's pretty obviously just one of the guys coming back from going to the toilet or something. Just a bit
in a big coat. Trousers.
And I imagine they're taking it with like a, hey, look, he's going for a poo, hey.
Yeah.
You know, they're just obviously joking around. I reckon they'll laugh when they do the photo. But
and, yeah, the weather would be a bit blurry because of the weather or the equipment. Oh, anything. Distance.
Anything. Yeah. But it's just weird how what seems to be, in my opinion, two jokes for a group of mates has speculated, has turned 60 years, has turned into, like, people convinced of the Yeti's existence.
Well,
oh, it's dumb. Anyway. and similarly, with tongues and eyes missing, perhaps because it's a little bit reminiscent of, like, cat mutilations or abductions and dissections, aliens obviously came into it.
Yeah.
There's an eerie photo captured by one of the group. It shows a glowing light in the centre of the frame with a sort of thick semicircle of lights to the top right of the frame. It does look a bit weird, admittedly, but it has been largely dismissed as an accidental photo snapped by a technician later in the lab when they're allies in the film. And I read quite a detailed explanation of why that photo would have been taken. And it's essentially because, like, the way that you prime a camera before you take a photo, you had to, like wind it up or something,
okay.
And he was trying to safely look at the film, and to get it out he needed to make sure it was like not winded up, it's something like that. So basically he took a photo, the film happened to be wound up, so it snapped the photo, and then he removed the film. So it's just the most mundane, boring and we'll put that photo up as well because it's kind of cool, but it's people like, oh, there's lights in the sky,
making a big thing out of a little thing.
So that photo I think is really dumb. I don't think it holds much water. However, there is some weird stuff surrounding this, not necessarily UFO idea, but idea of something in the sky.
Okay.
So,
because you mentioned the helicopter earlier.
Yeah, exactly. So there are a few weird details, like I said. The lead investigator for the Dyatlov Pass was a man named Lev Ivanov, and he lived for ages. He was still around about the 2000s. In 1990s, he gave an interview and admitted that he was forced to omit all mentions of unknown flying objects in the sky from the official report, of which the native Mansi tribe, there was quite a few testimonies from them that they saw this.
Okay.
And also the tops of the some pine trees are reported to have been burnt, which also was not allowed in the actual...
Oh, they couldn't public disclose that.
No, they couldn't say it. It's also strange that such a career politician... He was a prosecutor, but he's very much in the Soviet establishment. Would be so interested in UFOs. In 1990, he released an article called "The Enigma of the Fireballs," which we'll come on to later. And in the 60s, he made several attempts to access KGB archives, but what came from these attempts, we just don't know.
Okay.
So there is some weirdness around. So again, it's
could it be a plane or something?
No, I mean, I've got a theory that. I know what he thinks it is, and we'll probably finish on that one because I think it's
okay. We'll come back.
It's certainly interesting.
But something in the sky and the tops of trees burnt. They weren't allowed to
talk
about it.
Yeah. And then there's a whole group of theories that I didn't get to researching this one, which talks. They talk about secret, it being a place for like secret missile tests, and sort of these vague menacing nuclear weapons that killed all the hikers in a horrific way, and that's why they're nuclear. That's why they're nuclear active. That's why
radioactive. Yeah.
So there's quite a few grouped ones, and I'll come back to that. But that's sort of, yeah.
Interesting. I thought that could be possibly explained slightly easier than the other ones. Terms of what that could be in the sky.
What do you mean?
Well, there's so many possibilities. It was just a light, right?
Yeah. So the Mansi saw like a lot of lights previously. I mean, yeah, it could have been a lot of things, but that sort of, you know, that it is known that in the area there were some weird lights in the sky.
Sights.
And then you get like a weird sort of UFO looking thing, and their tongues are cut out and blah blah blah. And maybe that's. And then again, why would they leave the tent if they heard a UFO? Surely you'd stay. You know, see it falls apart.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
See, yeah, immediately.
Just you think about it for 2 seconds, you're like, well, that doesn't quite make sense. I don't know. It's just this bloody thing.
Yeah,
this bloody
case. Okay, so okay, I've got a theory which I think personally answers a lot of questions and is probably the most believable. I'm going to do two. I think both of them equally as believable as each other. The first one is the idea that there could have been an avalanche. So this is one. Harry doesn't believe this, but this is one of the original.
It's boring
ideas because it doesn't have any. We'll get to it. It's one of the original explanations that first came around, and probably I think makes the most sense, but we'll see. And basically, it suggests that an avalanche caused indirectly the hikers' deaths, and that's basically it. So one of this guy called Benjamin Radford in a magazine briefly explained it. So I'm just going to read what he says. So the group woke up in a panic and cut their way out the tent because an avalanche had covered the entrance to their tent, or because they were scared that an avalanche was imminent. So it was better to have potentially a repairable slit in the tent than risk being buried alive under tons of snow. They were poorly clothed because they had been sleeping and ran to the safety of the nearby woods where the trees would help slow oncoming snow. And in the darkness of night, they got separated into two or three groups. One group made a fire, hence the burnt hands. The cedar group, yeah. While the others tried to return to the tent to recover their clothing, and since the danger had apparently passed away. But it was too cold and they all froze to death before they could locate their tent in the darkness. And at some point, some of the clothes they may have been recovered or swapped from the dead. But at any rate, the group of four whose bodies were most severely damaged were caught in an avalanche and buried under 4 meters of snow, which more than enough to account for the compelling natural force the medical examiner described equivalent to a car crash. Injuries that would be equivalent to the force of a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
And Dubinina's tongue was most likely removed by scavengers and predation afterwards.
Mm-hmm. So eaten by animals afterwards. Like.
Yeah. So there's lots of contradictions to the story of things that don't really add up. So I'm just going to... There's quite a lot. I'm going to read them out to you. Harry's got so many questions. I'm going to read this and then you can ask more questions afterwards, yeah?
Thanks, Mum.
Okay. So this is the evidence contradicting the avalanche theory. So the location of the incident did not have any obvious signs of an avalanche having taken place. An avalanche would have left certain patterns and debris distributed over the wide area. The bodies found within a month of the event were covered with a very shallow layer of snow. And had there been an avalanche of sufficient strength to sweep away the second party, these bodies would have been swept away as well. So this would have caused more serious different injuries in the process and would have damaged the tree line as well. Okay, the second one is over 100 expeditions to the region were held since the incident. This, by the way, this is sort of after the report, the 1959, because there was a second inquiry that came around later.
Yeah, very recently. It was one that came very recently.
Yeah,
so which it was like 19,
we'll get on.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, we'll get on to. So the expeditions to the region, none of them reported conditions that might create an avalanche. A study of the area using up-to-date terrain-related physics revealed...
Ooh, like what? But just name some terrain-related physics for me, can you?
Just some, like, tech. they revealed that the location was entirely unlikely for such an avalanche to have occurred. The dangerous conditions found in another nearby area, which had significantly steeper slopes and... were observed in April and May when the snowfalls of winter were melting. During February, when the incident occurred, there was no such conditions.
So you're saying, like, was it like too cold for avalanches? Like, the snow too compacted?
Not the, maybe like the where, how the wind was. Was there anything above them, like cliff faces, stuff like that?
Yeah.
That would, what would cause...
Also, what, Mount Ototen wasn't that steep, was it? Like, it wasn't terribly steep for a... like, where they were wasn't that steep for an avalanche.
No. Well, I think that's what they're saying. The area nearby...
Oh, I see, yeah.
It wouldn't correlate.
Yeah, so that's what I mean by the terrain-related physics and the conditions of the...
Yep. Yeah.
Such terrain-related physics. My favourite kind of physics, actually.
Terrain-related. an analysis of the terrain...
Oh, here we go.
The slope and the incline indicates that even if there could have been a very specific avalanche... that circumvents the other criticisms, its trajectory would have bypassed the tent and had collapsed laterally, because the tent had collapsed laterally and not horizontally the way that a land avalanche would hit it.
I see, yeah.
So Datlov was an experienced skier, and the Zolotaryov...
Nearly, eh? It's called Sasha. 38-year-old Sasha.
Zolotaryov. Sasha was studying for his master's certificate in ski instruction and mountain hiking, and neither of these two men would have been likely to camp anywhere in the path of a potential avalanche. And finally, the footprint patterns leading away from the tent were inconsistent with someone, let alone a group of 9 people, running in panic from either real or imagined danger. In fact, all the footprints leading away from the tent towards the woods were consistent with individuals who were at a normal walking pace. Mm-hmm. So those are the gaps in the theory that don't make sense.
Quite a lot.
It's quite a lot, isn't it? I feel like... There's 1, 2,
sorry,
three, 5. He's attacking me.
I'm so sitting here so smugly listening to all that. Yeah, it all doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Okay, well, let me try my hardest, sure, to convince you otherwise.
Also, don't you think if it was actually an avalanche, we wouldn't still be wondering what happened 60 years later? Like, avalanches were the first thing you think of.
True. Okay.
I'll take my piece.
Okay. So I'm going to suggest some answers to this so-called contradicting evidence, because I think it actually makes sense if you have more story, details of story. So I read some of the investigation, because they reopened the investigation in 2015 to 2019, so literally very recently, and it revisits this theory, and they provide some answers to questions. So first of all, when we think of an avalanche, we imagine huge tons of snow, like, bulleting down a hill, mountainside, incredible speeds, right? But instead, the report supposes that it was a small avalanche that isn't actually that dramatic. So the tent was in the open without any natural barriers, and the hikers had dug down into the snow in order to make their tent secure enough to sleep in. And in the process of this, they loosened the top layer of snow. And in the night, the snowfield above the tent starts to slide down and slip. And it slips onto the entrance of the tent. So the snow is above them, sliding down, and it covers the entrance, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like, oh my goodness, I can hear an avalanche coming, it's crashing towards me, we need to get out quickly now. They're probably asleep, and then the snow's slipping down on top of them, and the snow underneath the tent is slipping as well, so the tent's sort of moving with it.
Right.
And so then they wake up, and they see that all the snow's piled onto the entrance, and they have to get out. But it's not like a really fast avalanche, right? They get outside quickly, but they're only walking because they realise that they're not in any big immediate danger, but there's no need to get out of the way in case they need to get out of the way because the avalanche might get worse.
Right.
Yeah? And they're also walking because it's minus 40 degrees. Hard to run if you're that cold. Okay, so...
Is it?
Yeah, that's what the committee says.
All right.
Which
committee? I want to speak to this committee.
The committee, yep. So,
Committee of Shills.
This investigative committee, on request of the families, confirmed the avalanche with a number of important details added.
Like what?
Okay, we'll get on to it. First of all, the committee investigators, one of them was an experienced alpinist. I'm not entirely sure what that is.
An alpinist?
God,
I love trees.
Oh, no, I was thinking like the Alps.
Oh, the Alpines. He probably understands the Alps.
Yeah.
Alpinist.
That's a weird... I didn't question that word when I read it, but then now I'm thinking...
I guess he just knows the Alps.
Yeah.
Power to him.
Yep. He confirmed that the weather on the night of the tragedy was very harsh, with wind speeds up to hurricane force of 20 to 30 metres per second, which is about 70 miles an hour, and that there was a snowstorm and temperatures that reached or dropped to minus 40 degrees. So these factors were not considered by the original investigating team in 1959, who arrived at the scene of the accident 3 weeks later. And this is when the weather had much improved and any remains of snowslide would have settled down and covered with fresh snowfall. And the harsh weather at the same time played a critical role in the events of the tragic night, which has been reconstructed in the report. So I'm now going to read you what they think happened. Okay?
Boo.
So this is what they say. On the 1st of February, the group arrives at the mountainside.
What's it called?
I'm not going to say that. I can't.
No, go on. It's a Mansi word.
Colat Seacle.
Lovely job.
And they erect a large 9-person tent on an open slope.
Should it be a 10-person tent?
Well, that's true, actually.
See? These people don't know what they're talking about.
That's true, yeah. Without any natural barriers, such as forests. On the day... and a few preceding days, a heavy snowfall continued with strong wind and frost. The group traversing through the slope and digging the tent into the snow weakens the snow base, and during the night, the snowfield above the tent starts to slide down slowly under the weight of the new snow, gradually pushing on the tent fabric, starting from the entrance. So the group wakes up and starts an evacuation in panic, with only some able to put on warm clothes. And since the entrance was blocked, the group escapes through a hole cut in the tent, in tent fabric, and descends the slope to find a place perceived as safe.
Right. So they, they just feel themselves moving. Is that it?
So yeah, they know that the symptoms of an avalanche, the start of an avalanche. You know that they start slowly and then they pick up speed quickly.
Right.
So they know that an avalanche might happen.
So if they cut their way out of the tent, and they realize, oh, we're not in any danger. What stops them going back?
But because avalanches pick up speed really quickly.
But why not run then?
Because at that time they didn't need to run because it was.
But if they don't need to run, then why didn't they go back and get some warm
clothes? Because they think the avalanche is going to get worse.
Yeah, but they're walking.
Yeah, they're walking away because they need to find a safe space until they deem.
But surely you'd run
because
away.
Because when an avalanche starts, you and from loose snow, it's very easy to get picked up in it.
Okay, so it'd be dangerous. Okay, so they can't. But then, if the air around the tent is dangerous, that's what you're saying, yes? That's why they can't go back, because...
Yeah, because they can't go back into the tent and get...
So why wouldn't you go a bit quicker than a walk? That's my gripe.
Because they don't need to walk. They don't need to run away, because the avalanche hasn't got bad yet, but they need to not go back.
I just feel like they'd at least jog then.
No,
So the danger isn't here yet, but it's coming. I would hustle a bit to keep warm as well.
They might have been a brisk walk. Quick walk.
I think I've read over and over again that it was at the pace of people who were like leisurely.
Okay, well, we'll keep going, shall we?
Yeah.
So they only walk away from the tent because they realise they're not in any immediate danger as the avalanche is slow moving, but they decide they must still leave in case it picks up quickly. It is also minus 40 and their vision is impaired from the darkness and the terrible weather. This is what the report says, yeah? This is not my words.
Oh, I hate the report. They suck. Never believe them.
Due to some of the members having incomplete clothes, the group splits. Two of the group only in their underwear and pyjamas were found in the Siberian pine tree forest.
The cedar group.
Near a fire pit, their bodies were found first and confirmed to die of hypothermia. Three hikers, including Dyatlov, attempted to climb back to the tent, possibly to get sleeping bags.
That would be Slobodin, and then Koshenko, and then... Slobodin, Koromogorva, and Dyatlov.
Uh-huh. And they had better clothes than those at the fireplace, but they were still quite light and their footwear was incomplete. Their bodies were found at various places ranging from 300 to 600 metres from the campfire in poses that suggest that they fell down of exhaustion while trying to climb in deep snow in fairly, in extremely cold weather. Not fairly cold weather.
Chilly weather.
Yeah. And the remaining four, equipped with warmer clothes and footwear, were apparently trying to find or build a better a camping place in the forest further down the slope. Their bodies were found only 70 metres from the fireplace under several metres of thick thick layers of snow, with traumas indicating they fell into a snow hole formed above a stream and their injuries sustained from hitting rocks below. And their bodies were only found after 2 months. So according to the investigation, the factors contributing to the tragedy were extremely bad weather and lack of experience of the group leader in such conditions, which led to a selection of dangerous camping place. And after the snowslide, another mistake of the group was to split up rather than build a temporary camping place down in the forest and trying to survive through the night. And also the negligence of the 1959 investigators contributed to their report, creating more questions than answers and inspiring numerous conspiracy theories. So there's the avalanche theory. What's your main criticism is the fact they weren't running?
That just seems to be a really weird. I can't understand why they would think that. That yes, there's a lot of danger. We're in danger. We have to slice by the 10. We can't go back to that 10 right now, and that could get much worse. But we'll walk. I feel like even I don't know. I just think they would be more conscious of. They'd either pace the way out of danger, they're very experienced, or they'd know they had time to go and get more gear. Like they could do that, but only later on, don't they? They come. That's what that's saying. That three of them try and get more gear.
They decided that the there was no danger, so they were going to go back.
Yeah, I don't know. That's my gripe. It's just that I don't understand where their thinking comes into it. And I didn't know that last bit about having to go all the other conspiracy theories. Why? Because you're afraid we're going to find the truth.
I think you're scared that I found the truth.
I'm not scared that you found the truth.
I think you are. I can see it in your eyes. Look at me.
I'm not afraid of you.
I can see you're whimpering.
I'm not afraid
your
of you.
Your lips are whimpering.
I'm not afraid of you, and I don't think it all adds up.
If you don't believe this theory, the next one I'm going to do, I think might convince you slightly more.
All right, let's hear it.
Okay, so my final theory is called the catabatic wind theory.
Good, let's hear it.
And I think I think it's convincing. So in 2019 a Swedish-Russian expedition was made to the site, and the people who went, the hikers, they suggested that a violent catabatic wind is a likely explanation for the incident. So catabatic winds are rare events but have the potential to be extremely violent. It's essentially when cold air over a glacier or a mountainous area starts to flow down a gradient, picking up speed as it goes, and it's a wind that carries high density air from a higher elevation down a slope.
So it's kind of like
cold air picking up speed, mixing with hot air, creating a high density.
And then you go over a glacier. So it's kind of like in Mario Kart when you go over like a special little fast bit of road,
like a zoom.
Yeah.
So it can escalate to the speed of a hurricane, and the topography of these locations were noted to be very similar to that of the site of the tent. And also an interesting note in the Datlov Group diary describes a relatively warm wind associated to a jet engine. So obviously sounded odd to them that they wrote it in their diary. What's important to realise regarding falling winds, which is another name for catabatic winds, is that these appear as quickly as opposed to a storm. So a storm would give you time to dress, secure, or dismantle a tent properly. But in the case of the Atlov group, the only survivable scenario would be to run out or get out the tent quickly, conceal the tent with snow, and wait out the ordeal elsewhere later to regain buried equipment. So if you look at images, and I'll put one on the Instagram, the tent, one side of it was covered with snow, which the one thing is, why did they slash out the tent?
Mm-hmm.
But
would it be maybe perhaps the sound of the wind?
Possibly, yeah. But they got out the tent, covered the tent with snow.
No, but then sorry, but then surely that's another one where it's like
the
danger's inside. No, the danger's not inside. The danger's outside. Why go outside?
Yeah. It could be the case that they thought that the winds were an avalanche. That's why they cut out the tent. Maybe. But one of the fastest way to save the tent from disappearing in the wind would be to cover it with adjacent snow masses. And in turn,
to anchor it down,
and this is expected if you're in the scenario. That's the guidance what you should do. So in the event of cataclysmic wind, the Dyatlov team acted skillfully by shadowing that advice. This could explain why the tent was located with a protective snow cover. Similar to the avalanche that we said, and a flashlight likely to use as a beacon for relocating the position. So there was a torch left on top of the tent. They could have said left on so that they could get back to the tent later and find it.
Mm-hmm.
So in the photos taken by the rescue team, clear traces of snow affected by strong wind can be seen pointing towards the tent from the peak of the mountain. And the actual pattern demonstrates heavy wind-swept snow where vortexes have hollowed out scoop-shaped cavities. So that's basically what... the nature of a catabatic wind...
What wind?
Catabatic wind.
Yeah.
It makes impressions in the snow that are found... in photos.
Have you seen footage of catabatic winds over a lake? That's a really good one, and it's nuts, so I recommend that. Maybe we should put that on our Instagram page. We've got a lot of stuff. We've got a big post coming on Instagram page.
Exciting. We have to go into the archives. So extremely high winds would furthermore make it hard to stand upright. Any possible ice sheets or other flying objects besides extremely low temperatures generated through the cooling effect could theoretically create body trauma, so that would explain some of the injuries possibly. And the same can be expected from traces of radioactivity and insect clothes associated to earlier commitments in the industry by members of the group.
So them being atomicists.
Yeah. So that's my last theory. What do you think?
I was in a big shrug.
Same as all of
them. A big shrug for those listening at home. Yeah, I don't know. There still holes to me.
I just think
if it's catastrophic winds, then how?
Why? And if they had time to pile snow on the tent, why did they not have time to get coats?
Get other stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't make any sense. Oh, yeah, doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, disproven. All right. Good news, because I have solved it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Don't you look at my notes. All right. It is ball lightning.
Ball lightning
is what it sounds like. It's lightning that takes the shape of a ball and flies around all willy-nilly and then can sometimes explode.
Oh my goodness.
Ball lightning has been reported for centuries, but scientific consensus treats the unexplained phenomena very skeptically. So it might be real, it might not be real. Science isn't sure, but people have been saying it's been happening for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Okay, right.
Oh
wait, so is that not a real thing then?
It might be a real thing. It's just it hasn't been demonstrated really.
Like, you can't really capture it. It's so rare.
It's really rare. Okay, really rare.
I see.
And this is what has been attributed to the Mansi's UFO sightings. They saw these glowing orbs. People say, oh, it's ball lightning.
Okay.
The theory goes that they cut a little hole in their tent so they could observe something funny, something interesting in the lights in the sky even, right?
They cut the hole.
Because there's little slits and there's giant slits.
I see.
So they cut a little one just to peek out.
Yeah.
This will also explain the mysterious UFO picture.
But that sounds like a ridiculous thing to do, because these guys are here.
They didn't slash the tent open yet. They just done a little hole on the top.
I know, but even doing that sounds like a ridiculous thing to do for experienced hikers.
Well, you can
in -40.
You can sew it back up. You can fix it. It's only a small hole.
I don't think. Why didn't they unzip the tent?
This is a very small detail.
Okay.
God sake.
Well, why would you rip your tent? Why wouldn't you unzip it?
The lightning, however,
ignoring me,
hovers close to the tent, forcing them out as it heats up the surrounding area, melting the snow, becoming unbearably hot.
Okay.
It's lightning. So they slash their way out, right? So they make their way to the tree line.
Walking, though.
Well, yeah, because it flies away again.
It flies away again. Yeah. But if it's lightning, that makes it...
Ball lightning, the way it works, apparently, it sort of just goes... It's very erratic.
But
just goes
if it's really rare, how do they name this much information?
This is what they can piece together from this.
Okay.
The two bodies were found at a cedar tree had been electrocuted, explaining the burn marks on their skin and the clothes and the blood from their mouths. The ball lightning then exploded, killing four of the members, explaining the extreme blood injuries. Then,
exploding them?
Yep.
Then, this is the trauma injuries?
Yeah. Then the three left tried to get up to the tent. Rustin's Lebanon is badly hurt with a skull injury, and Kolmogorov tries to help him, but as he can't walk, very well, because remember he's the guy who had the really weird, like, skull injury when he was alive. Do you remember that?
Okay.
Last week. Rustin can't make the walk. However, he's too badly injured. And he succumbs to his injuries. Kolmogorov tries her best to keep going, but the exhaustion from helping her friend is too much, and she collapses too. Igor Dyatlov is the last one left. Is now the only, like, uninjured member of the group. He's back at the ravine with the four who were sort of blown up.
Mm-hmm.
Despite their awful wounds, Ludmilla and Sasha are still clinging to life. Dyatlov returns to his two dead friends by the cedar tree, takes off their clothes, and then turns them over solemnly and respectfully. He gives their clothes he's gathered and maybe some of his own to his dying friends, and then eventually decides to get back to the tent, but he dies of hypothermia before he gets there. This is a really interesting theory, and I think it's the only one that can give a full account of what happened. And it was favoured by Lev Ivanov, who was the investigator,
mm-hmm.
But he was forced to admit it from the original explanation, investigation. It just doesn't feel satisfying, though, does it? It just doesn't feel satisfying to credit this phenomena to something we can't actually prove is real.
Yeah.
So this is the only thing I'm like, okay, well, that's a story, and that makes kind of sense. But ball lightning has not been proven to be real.
I just think if it was real, even if we didn't have photos or something, there would be more... I feel like it would be documented, famous.
Well, I mean, how long have we had proper cameras? Like, well, like, not that long, really, you know? And it's mm-hmm. I assume more research on ball lightning itself. But it is interesting, I think, that the official investigator was really interested in this. And remember that I said he wrote that article in the 90s, the Enigma of the Fireballs. So he believed this one. So the guy in charge, who was sworn to secrecy, who looked at KGB disclosed documents,
yeah.
who was sanctioned and silenced by the government, believed this theory. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So there's so like.
But I just think if so, you say that they're in their tent. The first detail I don't like is that they decided to cut, even if it was a small hole.
Yeah.
In their tent, in very very.
Well, they've already got a hole in the tent because they've already got like a flap or anything because you got the exhaust for the stove.
Yeah, but why would you want to make any more? Why would you want to damage the tent? Why did they not open the flap?
Hmm?
Why would they not open the flap? Why would they not open the door?
Too big of a hole.
Pardon?
Too big of a hole.
To what?
Too big of a hole. The hole's too big. It's too chilly.
Just zip open a tiny bit of the door. Like, there's so...
Oh, you've got zips now, have you?
If you're in...
Right, you're shill.
The entrance of the tent.
No.
Why? If you're in minus 40 degrees and it's and also it's really windy,
they know something.
Why would you purposely damage your
tent?
Right,
now we're shouting at each other. Now
okay. And then also,
like, okay,
if you heat
right,
up...
Right, Beatrix.
Let me finish.
You're asking me questions.
No, I'm also asking another one. If you're heat up in your tent, the ball lightning strikes around them. They get very hot,
no,
so they slash open the
it's
tent.
It's not striking. It's just hovering near them. You're okay. Not listening to me.
Okay. It hovers near them, gets really hot.
Yeah.
Right? So they slash open the tent.
Yes.
But then they walk away.
This because it goes away.
Yeah, but it's still a danger. Like, would you not be terrified if that happened to you?
But now it's not in the distance. It's like the distance.
No, if something was hovering near you and heated you up, you would want to
it
get away
was
quickly.
Hovering near you a minute ago, but now it's not.
Harry, if this was the other way around, you'd be ripping me.
No, Trixie, no. Listen to me, right? There's something about this one which, for some reason, the main guy in charge of everything, he's in charge of the whole thing, was like, yeah, like, years later, he finally came out and said, this is what I think it is. Why would he do that? I think the way the theories fall, there's two kinds of theories with this case. The theories that are more normal and credible and realistic, but there are glaring holes in them, which don't make sense.
Yeah, where's
and then there's the nuts ones that are too nuts to be real.
Mm-hmm.
This is just too nuts to be real. But that's why it's real.
Yeah. I don't know.
Right. So thanks for listening, guys. That's been our episode on the other past. I solved it. Beatrix didn't.
No. So thank you for listening to our very interesting analytical episode on the Dyatlov Pass.
Yep. This one, I think, this sort of side episode where we look at one thing in more detail and we slow down a bit, I think I personally enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
So I think we might be doing this more often, and maybe we'll call it, you know, like
the worst podcast investigates.
Nice, slick.
And you probably already know that because it'll be the cover of the podcast.
Yeah.
Unless we change our minds.
Unless we change our minds.
It's thoroughly good fun.
Yeah, and I think I got to say, some good research.
Thank you.
I did most of it, but only because my obsession demanded it from me, otherwise I couldn't get to sleep.
Maybe I'll choose the next one.
Yeah, and some more neutral, because otherwise I'll lose you.
I think towards the end, we were gonna rip each other.
Yeah, I think it's nice to be able to close the book on this just for a bit.
Like, I think.
Because I solved it, which is great. We're done now. Bitch, except it's done. We can shout each other on the walk home. Right. Thanks,
anyway,
guys.
Join us next week for another episode.
And hopefully me and Bill will have made up.
We'll
by
be
then.
Friends again by then.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.